Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
All right, good morning. It's Sunday, June 22nd, 2008. That makes this Solder Smoke 86. Very kind of warm summer morning here in Rome. You might hear some fans running in the background. It's summertime. Listen, what I was going to start out with this morning, I've got a new microphone here, so we've had some technical improvements. From time to time, I ask for comments on the audio, and people have commented that I needed to put some sort of a screen in front of the mic to prevent the popping on the P sounds, and I've heard it when I've listened, and it's bothered me. So I've come up with a homebrew solution to a pretty much homebrew microphone for a show about homebrew, and I hope it works. Guys, let me know if there's been any improvement in the popping. But let me tell you about the mic here. Now it's some feedback there. Let me turn that down. I might have to work on that a bit. Anyway, the microphone, it's still the same old ugly mic. I'm going to try to put a picture up on the blog. Just an old computer mic that I found somewhere. It's held together by duct tape. It's the mic stand itself is the famous third hand from Radio Shack. And I started out by putting a bit of styrofoam around it with a rubber band. The styrofoam, not styrofoam, it's sort of like the foam from your from old Walkman headphones. I wrapped some of that around it. That didn't seem to do the trick. I seem to need some more protection against the P sounds. So people came up with the suggestion that I come up with some sort of a screen, a circular screen in front of the mic, and it was suggested that I use like nylon from stockings and stretch them across, make a kind of a screen in front of the mic. I came up with something that's similar. You guys will get a kick out of this, I think. I found in a hardware store a little plastic thing that you put in a bathtub drain to prevent, wedding rings and stuff from going down there. And in my case, it's particularly important because the kids at one point were playing with little marbles, and they decided to play with them in the bathtub, and a number of them went down the drain pipe, and believe me, that's not good. This building is that we're in is sort of Mussolini era or prior, and the pipes they could do without the insertion of large numbers of marbles. So anyway, I bought these kind of little plastic drain things in there, and it turns out that I had an extra one, and it's just about perfect to fit over the microphone. And then for the screen itself, I found this kind of tissue-like material that they use in for baby wipes. We had a kids' party here, and my wife bought some baby wipes to clean off to clean the chocolate off the faces of all the no longer baby kids. But I discovered that one of these things, when it dried out, the thickness was just about perfect. So now that we have the baby wipe material stretched over the drain pipe plug, that and the whole thing just is held on there with, of course, the required amount of duct tape, and the whole thing is fit over the microphone. And it's ugly. It's really ugly, but I'm pleased with it because it, like I said, a homebrew mic for a homebrew show. Before we get into the real subject matter of the day, let's start with a little bit of Italian travelogue. Since we last spoke, one trip that we took. It was to one of our favorite locations. It's called it's a place called Lago Bracciano, and Bracciano is a town about, I guess it takes us about an hour to get there. It's probably only about 20 miles or less north of Rome, and a beautiful volcanic lake. It's one of the sources of water for the aqueduct system that still provides drinking water for Rome. They found human settlements there that go back 9,000 years. When you're in Rome, you're accustomed to being around things that are 2,000 years old. At the place that I work, there are statues just sitting there as you as you eat your ham and cheese sandwich in the outside table, picnic bench kind of thing. You look up, and there, sitting next to you, is a statue that is really 2,000 years old. So, 2,000 year old stuff is not at all unusual, and it's visible just about everywhere you go in Rome. 9,000 year old stuff is well, it's going back a bit further, and they found a human settlement in what's now under Lake Bracciano. The level of the lake has risen, but as they were doing some dredging there, they came up with some interesting stuff, and apparently 9,000 years or so ago, a group of Greeks paddled their way up the river, decided that Bracciano was a really nice place, and stayed there, and they built a city there, and the city was apparently in operation for about 400 years. Bracciano is really beautiful. There's a wonderful little town of the same name there, and anyway, we go up there from time to time. The kids swim in the lake, and it's really beautiful. We were out on paddle boats on Bracciano, and of course I was thinking what a marvelous ground plane this would be, but I didn't bring a rig, so we weren't operating maritime mobile from the paddle boat on Bracciano, but I admit I did think about it, and which is an indication of a severe case of the knack. Speaking of which, Gene Shepherd. Guys, if you haven't seen it already, go to the blog, soldersmoke.blogspot.com, and you'll see, scroll down a bit, and you'll see the picture of Gene Shepherd shouting into the microphone of WOR New York. And I have there an article that has a link to a file of one of Gene Shepherd's 1965 shows on WOR. And in this particular episode is focused on ham radio and ham radio home brewing. And it's he doesn't use the term. I don't know if they had the scientific term at that point, but it's very clear from what Shepherd said that he had the knack, and he had a bad case of it. His case of the knack, guys, was so bad that he could not stop thinking about his technical homebrew troubleshooting problems, even when on a date with a beautiful young lady. He would be sitting there, and he'd go out on the date, and the girl's name was always something like Laura Jean or something like that. And he would be out there on the date, and he was there, but his mind was back in the shack. He was worried about his problem with his Heising modulator that was giving him downward modulation. And he was obsessed with it, obsessed to the point that the young lady asked him about it. When he explained the problem, she told him that she thought, quote, that there was something wrong with him, and that, quote, his mother should take him to see a doctor. But Shepherd explained that she just didn't understand what a serious thing it was to have, and what a terrible thing it is to have a piece of gear that you built not working properly, and it just gnaws at you. It just, man, I mean, when I heard this thing, of course, I sympathize with Shepherd. Shepherd said that Years later, he went back to his hometown after getting out of the army and a bunch of other things, and he was in a store, and he happened to run into this woman, and they kind of vaguely recognized each other, and yeah, I know you. Yeah, finally they made the connection, and she said, "Oh yeah, I remember. Yes, you with the radios." And then she kind of paused and she said, "Did you ever get help or solve that problem?" And of course, she was referring to the need for some sort of professional counseling. And Shepard said, he smiled and said, "Oh yes, that's been taken care of." And then he kind of chuckled to himself. He said, "Because I took care of the technical problem and I fixed the Heising modulator." All right, so three cheers for Gene Shepard. His last call sign was K2ORS. There is a link there. There's many links out there that where you can find Shepard shows. I'll publish some more of them, but you should go to the one that I put there. If you've never listened to a Gene Shepard show, listen to this one. Put it in your MP3 players. And you really enjoy it. On this particular episode, Shepard always takes a little while to get wound up and get to the subject of the day. But, stick through it. It's fun, too. It's kind of a trip back to 1965. there's commercials there for Miller beer. The champagne of bottled beers, as they say. So, check that all out. I, like Shepard, have had my share of technical troubles since we last spoke here, and I'll tell you about them now. In the last episode, we spoke with Mike WA6ARA, and I think we talked a little bit about his concept of iBorg kind of construction. These are rigs that are kind of put together from different modules, different circuits that can be moved around and formed into direct conversion receivers, and maybe add a filter and an IF chain and a different converter, and it becomes a superhead and all that kind of stuff. And I think I mentioned my idea that I have a box of circuit boards from projects that didn't quite get to completion. And sometimes the box is labeled boards that could become a rig. Well, in the last week or so, these boards have come together almost in a process of like spontaneous combustion, and have become a 30 meter a milliwatt transmitter for the QRSS, the slow speed CW project. My crystals arrived from the supplier in Germany. Very fine. The frequency is 10.140, but it's more complicated than that. And I'll tell you about the complexity in a moment. But I had a little oscillator board here. It was actually, you may remember, when Billy and I were flying back from vacation in the Dominican Republic. Or someplace, I was describing to him how an oscillator works, and we on the airplane kind of just designed a little little crystal controlled oscillator, and then we came back to the shack and built it and got it to run. Well, that board was sitting there, and I just made some minor changes and plugged in the 30 meter crystal, and well, we had a little bit of RF there, and then. For the amplifiers, when Mike KL7R and I had been talking about LT Spice and amplifier design, I had been moving back and forth between LT Spice and the workbench, building some little feedback amplifiers, two stages of feedback amplification, with looking for 50 ohms in to each stage, 50 ohms out, just make a 50 ohm system. And, there it was, and it works, and it produced about 20 dB a gain, and all very stable, all very, very Class A. And hey, I got a question. Here's the thing. When I pretty much stuck to Class A amplifiers on this thing, and I'm thinking that when you're down in the milliwatt and microwatt areas, you pretty much have to be Class A, because you never really get to the point where there's enough. There's enough to drive a stage into Class C. I just wonder if that's true, or if I'm just kind of imagining that. But anyway, so now we have an oscillator, we have an amplifier, and in the beacon box that is already functioning on 10 meters, I have the K1EL keyer, and well, looks like a plan. So I move the new 30 meter transmitter in there, and with some additional soldering and rigging up of switching, I put a band switch in there so I could switch between 10 meter beacon and 30 meter beacon, and I recorded a new beacon message for the slow speed CW. I made use of the solder islands, the little circular solder pads that Jerry, NR5A, our man in South Dakota, was kind enough to send. That was great fun too. It was just a part of the circuit. I needed some isolation pads there, and it was great fun to use the circular pads. My pads are normally kind of square or rectangular. I cut them out with tin shears, but Jerry sent me these really nice, neat pads, and it was just every time you use a piece of gear or a part or something sent from a friend, it makes the project a little bit more personal and significant. It makes a connection to that person. So, thanks, Jerry. Your solder island pads are now part of the Beacon project here in Rome. Anyway, the thing is ready to go. I fired it up and putting out now about 200 milliwatts on 10.140. But this is where. Shepard's kind of problems kick in, and this is where you get into the point of obsession. Murphy's Law struck. Maybe you guys can help me with this. I mean, we're not gonna resolve Murphy's Law, but this particular Murphy's Law problem. I have an old frequency counter here that I picked up at the Kempton Park Rally in London. Tony Fishpool, I think, was there that day, and this particular frequency counter was one of the items of test gear that made it home with Billy and me, and it worked, seemed to work okay. It has two inputs, one for below 40 megahertz, one for above, and the above 40 megahertz input wasn't working. The guy who sold me told me that, and I opened it up, and I could see they probably blew the, they probably put too much RF in it and blew the first transistor amplifier. It looks like they tried to fix it, but failed. But the 40 megs and below input, which is what interests me most, of course, was working just fine. But I rarely needed it. I didn't really need all those digits of precision on the frequency readout. But there it was, and it was nice to have the frequency counter. Sometimes I'd turn it on just to have the numbers kind of jumping around. You know what I'm talking about. Sometimes you turn on the scope and have something sinusoidal on the screen just to make it, I don't know, it just seems like the thing to do in the Radio Shack, you know? Of course, now I'm entering the project, the one project in many years that really, requires some frequency counting, and yeah, so of course, about a week before I need the thing, the frequency readout of the counter, well, the counter is down for the count, let's put it that way. I don't know what's wrong with it. The circuitry, you know, it's all Schmidt triggers and JK flip-flops and all kinds of digital stuff in there that I don't work with and haven't really studied. Lots of IC chips. It's kind of older technology, so there's a lot of discrete components in there also. It's not all just one big chip. But the symptom is that instead of having when I turn it on, instead of having like two zeros, a decimal point, and then the three zeros, it has two zeros, a decimal point, two more zeros, another decimal point, another bunch of zeros, and nothing I put in the input. Well, if I put input in there, it the numbers jump around a lot, but it's all gibberish. It's not related to the frequency input. Now, if I switch over to the high input, the decimal point and the zeros are where they should be. But when I switch over to the other input, to the 40 megs and below, I get this kind of strange mixture of decimal points and zeros. My first thought was that the problem was that the input transistor amplifier, which is an FET, might have been blown by perhaps me putting too much RF into this thing. But I tested it, and it's not that simple. I thought maybe I could just pop in an MPF 102, and then all would be right in the world. But it's not. It's not that simple, guys. It's something else in there. Now, I'm hoping that one of you brilliant digital wizards will send me an email with a really simple solution, you know, just something like, you know, ground pin 7 of U1, and everything will reset and the thing will work great. I don't think it's going to happen, but what the heck? Let me ask. If anybody knows how to fix this thing, let me know. Because here's the thing. I really need it now, and I'll tell you why I need it. I've discovered that the world of QRSS, slow speed CW, is it's really interesting. And I was drawn into this by the articles that Hans Summers has written for Spratt. He's written three or four articles for Spratt, and there's quite a lot about this on his website. And one of the things that really got me interested in it was his picture of his QRSS transmitter. It's a really ugly construction. It's a very simple little two- or three-stage rig, a crystal oscillator going to amplifiers. And with this thing, driven by a QRSS, a slow-speed CW generator, Hans's signal has been received literally all around the world, running something like 50 milliwatts. Of course, I mean, if you're a home brewer and a QRP guy, this is almost irresistible. And I did succumb to the call of the QRSS project. But here's what I found out. This is a new thing in ham radio for me, because it has always been for me that crystal control, that you have a crystal in there. You know what your frequency is. There it is. You're done. And there's no doubt about it. It's not like you've got some VFO or some homebrew VFO that may be putting you out on who knows what frequency. No, you've got a crystal in there. And the crystal is stamped 10.140, so that's where you are. And that should be enough, right? And I figured, well, I wouldn't have to worry too much about frequency. Maybe I'll put a little trimmer cap in there across across the crystal, and maybe wiggle it a little bit, but not too much. But now here's the problem: the entire band that is used by the QRSS gang. And they're known as the Knights of QRSS, and they have an email group called the Knights, and it's a very aptly named group because they're a real bunch of very helpful gentlemen. The Knights use a band that is, now listen carefully here, 100 hertz wide, not 100 kc, 100 hertz wide, and you've got to make sure that your transmitter is somewhere in that 100 hertz band, or they're not really going to be able to hear you, or more importantly, they're not going to be able to see you on their computer screens. And I have discovered, guys, that getting even a crystal control transmitter precisely in a 100 hertz segment of the band is not as easy as you'd think. It's really quite difficult. Especially, then I also discovered here, it suddenly occurred to me that I'm probably one of the few radio amateurs in the world that doesn't just have this gear in the shack by virtue of having a Kenwood Yaesu ICOM Super Duper 1000 triple Z X-ray transceiver. I have no glowing numerals here anywhere. I had some with the frequency counter, but now all the glowing numerals are gone. And the one of my most accurate frequency reading devices is the Drake 2B with the crystal calibrator. A crystal calibrator, by the way, that hasn't itself been calibrated probably since 1973, if then. So certainly not down to the 100 hertz level. So anyway, I now find myself really in great difficulty measuring the frequency. By the way, the Drake 2B, it may be a particularly bad case with my Drake 2B. Drake 2B suffers from, look, it's hard to talk bad about the Drake 2B. I have an emotional connection with my Drake 2B. All Drake 2B owners have this thing. It's a great receiver. And I've had mine since 1973. It's staring me right in the face right now as I speak into this microphone. As I look up above the mic, there is the Drake 2B from Miamisburg, Ohio, a communications receiver with a Q multiplier. It is not, however, the world's best device for accurately measuring frequencies. I'm not going to win any frequency measuring tests with this thing. It has dial parallax. I put on the blog that dial parallax sounds like some sort of horrible disease that comes along with the knack. You know, you can almost hear the doctor saying, yes, ma'am, I'm sorry to report that your son Dilbert has the knack. And he also has an additional set of symptoms, one of which is dial parallax. For those of you who don't know what dial parallax is, it's a problem completely unfamiliar to people who've grown up in the Yaesu, ICOM, Kenwood world, where frequency readout is by an actual dial, like with a little needle that, as you turn the frequency dial, the little needle moves up and down the scale and tells you what frequency you're on. The problem arises because the dial is, an eighth of an inch or so back from the glass with the numbers written on it. And this produces parallax. In other words, even if you're looking at the Drake 2B, if you look at it out of one eyeball, you get one frequency readout. If you switch over to the other eye, I'm doing it right now. Look, and by switching from eyeball to eyeball, the frequency readout of the Drake 2B moves by about 3 kc. 3,000 hertz, all right, just by moving eyeball to eyeball. These QRSS guys want me to be accurate within 100 hertz. How can I do that? How can I do that when I got a receiver that moves 3 kc's depending on which eyeball I'm using? Oh, man, I don't know. I've got to do something here. Now, of course, now I begin on-the-air tests. I call up my local friends here, ask them to listen for my beacon frequency, and tell me what frequency I'm on. But these guys, they're like me. They're not used to working down at 100 hertz. And they tell me, yeah, you're on 10.140. It's great. Sounds good. I'm saying, yeah, but I need 10.140 and then the three numbers after that. It's hard. Then, okay, here's another thing that goes on with QRSS. They have these things called grabbers. And all what they are is they're using some really great software, most of which developed by a fellow whose call is I2 PhD, Alberto, up in the Piedmont area, or Lombardy area, the Milan area of Italy. And you really should check out I2 PhD's Weak Signals website. Really great stuff. With a flair, with a real Italian sense of kind of beauty and design in there, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But they have It's basically a sound card-based system. You take the output of your receiver, put it into the sound card, and then it displays in kind of waterfall fashion what's coming through. Then you can calibrate. Of course, if you can, the calibration's the problem. If you can calibrate the output of it so that you can see accurately 100 hertz on the display, and then all the different QRSS signals that are coming in are displayed neatly one on top of each other, and you could read the slow speed CW. Of course, calibration remains the problem, and I don't even have any accurate signal sources to calibrate it. Anyway, this is the world of technical woe that I find myself in right now, and I must say I don't like it, and I it's inevitable, I think, that we get pulled into these kind of kind of software-based or software problems, because now it becomes a software problem because I've got to calibrate the software. And, man, I should really have a big sign up here saying, you know, only hardware problems will be addressed in this Radio Shack. And as soon as it becomes kind of a software issue, as soon as I start spending more time with the mouse than the soldering iron, I know that I'm heading for frustration. I will get this thing done. It's one of these things where a lot of times when you run into a really difficult technical problem, the best thing to do is just put it on the shelf for a while and go work on something else. And I think I'll do that. So there'll be more to follow. Take a look at the blog. I have some information about I2PhD's software, about the whole QRSS adventure. It is real good QRP stuff, real microwave stuff. I like the whole beacon concept. It kind of pulls it all together, and I will get it all together and get this thing together. But for now, it's going to sit on the shelf for a while. It raises some interesting topics. For example, and I hadn't thought about this too much, and it ties in with some recent discussions on mixers. Why is it that by slowing down the CW, you are able to use much more narrow filters? And of course, it's pretty obvious why the narrow filter helps you receive weaker signals. And you can actually really get a good sense of this when you play around with the Argo and Spectran software from I2PhD. You know, every time you narrow that the bandwidth, every time you use more narrow filters, you're letting less noise come through the system, so the signal to noise ratio improves. And even if you've got a really weak signal in there, just really, really weak, when you focus that filter right on that frequency, you're chopping off noise that otherwise would be coming through, and the signal to noise ratio improves, and that signal that was previously unreadable becomes readable. So of course, that's pretty easy to follow. What I'm finding intriguing is why is it that a regular CW signal, say transmitted at 20 words per minute, is broader than a really slow speed CW signal sent at say 0.1 word per minute? The QRSS system that most of us are using now has dits that are 3 seconds long, which is quite a long dit. The dit's 3 seconds, so it's really slow CW. It's so slow that when you're trying to when you put the message into the key, or you put it in at normal CW speed, but then it plays it back at this really slow speed, and it's really hard to follow it, because I mean the characters themselves, the letters, are so long that by the time you're listening to the last dit, it's hard to remember whether it started off with a dit or a dash. it's a trip, I'm telling you, getting into the really slow speed CW. It's not even really recognizable as CW, let me tell you. You can't just sit there and listen to it like you would 5 word per minute CW. It's so slow, it's like a different It's a complete, almost like a completely different medium. But anyway, the question is, why would slowing it down reduce the required bandwidth? And why couldn't you just use really narrow filters on 20 word per minute CW, and then we wouldn't have to go with this slow as molasses CW stuff? And it's really interesting. You get into some really fundamental stuff. You get into Shannon's information theory. But at a more basic level, you get into just kind of mixer theory. Because when you think about CW this slow, the whole transmitter becomes something of a, or certainly the keyed stage becomes something of a mixer, a modulator. And you're modulating that 10.140 signal with a basically an on-off system at, I guess, what, about 5 hertz or something like that? Yeah, 5 hertz, depending on your CW speed, and that's the key. At really slow speed, you're modulating with a much slower signal. And here's where it really gets kind of mind-blowing. The sidebands that arise, you're talking about CW sidebands that pop up. You don't hear that too often, CW sidebands, but on your CW signal there going on and off, there's these little sidebands off to the side. And if you're, I don't know, if say 20 words a minute is in effect a 5 hertz modulating signal, then you've got 10.140 with sidebands above and below at 5 hertz. Now, if your filter is narrower than that, you're going to get what they call, I guess, what the old-timers would call a filter ringing. The filters will ring, but basically you won't be able to make out the on and off of the CW. I haven't quite got my head around this thing, but this whole system, but there it is, and that's the way one of the QRSS websites described it, if I'm paraphrasing correctly. Michael, Alpha Alpha 1 TJ, our man in Vermont, sent me an email and with one of his very characteristic kind of poetic but and technically accurate useful descriptions, and it involved this shows you how kind of deep you have to get into this kind of stuff. We're getting almost into kind of mysticism here. But the example that Mike used involved a mongoose and a cobra. The mongoose was sitting there, and the mongoose and the cobra were kind of going, rocking back and forth with each other in sync. And then all of a sudden, one of the two, I can't remember whether it was the mongoose and the cobra, broke out of the oscillation and ate the other one up. And well, I'll have to take a look at Michael's example again. At the time, it seemed to be illuminating, but right now I'm not quite remembering it. So I'll review that and I'll let you guys know. Anyway, let's see what else we got here. I was in a uncomfortable but happy situation this week, and I almost ran out of solder. That's good, because sometimes Mike Kale7R used to say that we spent so much time talking about home brewing and doing solder smoke sessions that we didn't actually build anything. But I knew that I was I've been melting some solder, because when I looked at the workbench the other day, I realized that I was running out, and my normal supplier, Dan of Dan's Small Parts of Missoula, Montana. And Dan's still recovering from his accident. I checked the website yesterday, and he's still not in full operation. So I had to look for alternate suppliers, and Radio Shack came to the rescue. You could do mail order from Radio Shack, even from here, and I found this a lot of fun. Everybody talks bad about, not everybody, but some people talk bad about Radio Shack. But I used to love Radio Shacks when I lived in the States. I mean, there you are, and you're in the shopping mall, and there's all these stores selling, stuff that is of completely no interest, shoe stores, shop, ladies' purse stores, clothing stores, you know, endless clothing stores. How many clothing stores do they need? But there, amidst all this nonsense, there's a store that will sell you a 100 kilo ohm resistor. I mean, how good is that? Thank God for Radio Shack, guys. Really, you guys in the States, you don't know how good you have it. We don't have that over here. But I found the mail order site, and I sent off my order, including a request for 1 pound of 60/40 leaded rosin solder, and it came. So my solder emergency is resolved. I bought a whole bunch of other parts, too. I bought a bunch of low-value resistors because those are the ones that we use up more frequently. And I bought some IRF 510 MOSFETs, thinking about RF projects, MPF 102s, some 2N3NO4 NPN transistors for drivers. Those little clip leads, those little Radio Shack colored test leads with the alligator clips, those are great. And they seem to disappear. They seem somehow you start out the year with 20 of them. At the end of the year, they're gone. I don't know where they go, but they go anyway. I got a bunch of those. What else? Fuse holders. Somehow the fuse holders, they don't last too long. The plastic gets all brittle and they decay. So I needed a bunch of those. Heat sink material. Yeah, I bought some Radio Shack heat sink stuff and the mounting kits. And anyway, it was a good day when the box from Radio Shack came, so that was good. A neighbor moved, and as he left, he asked me if I wanted some of the older electronic stuff. He gave me a really old computer and a monitor. I just couldn't say no. I took it. I opened it up, man. I knew that this computer was just too old and too messed up and too dirty, so I just stripped it. You know, what I found in there that it was good, I don't know if any of you guys are using this too, but just the all those little connector cable wires in there, the whole thing, you know, to connect the various components, to connect the hard drive to the motherboard, to the floppy drive, to the CD-ROM drive, all those wires. It looks like that's really good wire for homebrew construction projects. It's all stranded, insulated stuff with all kinds of different colors in there. So, man, I just went in there with the wire clippers and came up with a really good supply of homebrew project wire. It's all about, you know, 6 inches or a foot long, which is just right for most of the stuff that we need. And I kept it to the connected to the little connectors at the end, which makes it convenient. I just hung it up there above the workbench, and so now when I need 6 inches of red stranded wire, I go to the computer refuse, and yeah, that was good. Found a nice heat sink in there also, so that was fun. What else got here? Oh, another thing arrived in the mail, a new copy, and this is, I got a really nice copy of Aid Weiss's History of QRP. I've been talking about that on the show, and I've got something on it on the blog. What a beautiful piece of work this is. And I've been enjoying it. I've been just jumping around in the book, reading about the QRPers of days gone by. And there's a few of these books available on Amazon.com. Please go through the Solder Smoke bookstore when you buy it, because then, you know, Radio Shack will send us a few cents. But not Radio Shack, Amazon. I haven't figured out how to get money out of Radio Shack yet. Working on that one. You really got to get a copy of Aid Weiss's book, A History of QRP. Belongs on every true radio amateur and true QRP or true home brewer webs, true home brewer's bookshelf. So get it. You'll really enjoy it. And it's amazing how our particular brand of ham radio mania goes back, way back, to the very earliest days of the hobby. That's a real strong recommendation here. Let me look at my list. We've got the Mongoose and the Cobra, the Frequency Counter, Running Out of Solder, the Radio Shack Package, the Computer Refuse. All right, I think we've about covered it here, guys. But that still brings us to...
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love him.
Indeed.
Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. First up, some good news. From our man in Bangalore, now our man in Singapore, Ramakrishnan, VU3RDD, a new harmonic has arrived. The first, a beautiful baby girl born last Friday. Not sure whether it's whether the baby was born in. I think the baby was born in Singapore, or they might have gone back to Bangalore. But in any case, congratulations, Ramakrishnan. Mother and baby are doing well, and the congratulations on the new arrival. That's really great. Let's see, other mail we got here. I got an email from Frank. He didn't give a call sign, but he talked a little bit about the advantages of analog scopes, analog versus digital scopes. This is something that I think generates a lot of kind of heated discussion. But Frank noted some advantages of old analog scopes, and it made me feel better because my scope is definitely analog and definitely old, so it made me feel a little bit better about it. A long-time listener and loyal correspondent here, PE1OIT, he told me that I've been mispronouncing his name, and I apologize. He said that I've been pronouncing his name as if he is the brother on the TV show Frasier. It's not Niles, it's Niels. Of course, Niels Bohr, of course, a very, very well-known name, and I don't know how I've been getting it wrong all this time. Niels, my apologies. He writes about, he requests some suggestions for how to get an antenna on the roof of an apartment house. He's in a situation similar to mine and similar to Ramakrishnan's now in Singapore, and I sent along some, hopefully some words of wisdom on my antenna situation here. He also, and here's where Niels starts dragging me into the world of the digital world that I'm trying to avoid. He talks about a chip. I'm sure many of you have heard of it, but the SI570 digital oscillator chip that apparently does wonders in generating RF from one very convenient little chip. Thanks for that, Niels, and we always look forward to your emails. Brian, KG4ENB, writes about some low-frequency action on, I guess it's 179 kilohertz, using a homebrew with a 555 timer transmitter. I don't think this is a ham band, but I think they have authorization. You could do experimentation there if you keep the power, effective radiated power, really low. Very interesting on that. And thanks for sending that our way, Brian. Nick, M0NJP, another longtime listener and who's made contribution over the years, sends us a 1959 article from one of the ham radio magazines on how it's advice to wives and girlfriends on how to deal with knack victims. And I kind of chuckle out of it, although it seems to have been written by a wife or girlfriend. And on several of these pieces of advice, and my conclusion was that she really didn't know what she was talking about, because the advice that she gave, in some cases, it just wouldn't help at all. But one that I think would be useful, and what she advises her fellow wives and girlfriends is, don't keep asking when it is going to be finished unless he mentions the subject first. Yeah, it being, of course, whatever's on the workbench, and that probably is good advice. When you're in that Gene Shepherd zone and the Heising modulator is not working properly, you don't want to be asked, well, when is it going to be finished? The other reason, and I think the article notes this a little bit further down the page, is that very often it's never going to be finished, Finnish just doesn't happen really in the homebrew world. So anyway, wow, seagulls. You guys might be able to hear the seagulls in the background. Seagulls that are flying up from the Tevere, a river, which is pretty close by here. Wow, loud this morning. All right. Sunday morning, waking everybody up. John, make sure I got the call right here. Yeah, John, K7JM, writes in from Montana. And John has contributed several times over the years about his adventures listening to Solder Smoke while on the road in Montana, out doing some field electronic maintenance work. And he said he was riding along listening to Solder Smoke where he had to make a stop on the road and make a repair. And he made the repair there just in the last month. Shows you how the weather can be in Montana. And as he was soldering the repair, a snowstorm began. So he had Solder Smoke in the headphones, a soldering iron fired up, and snow falling around him. And this made me think, bum bum, solder snow. All right. Thanks for that, John. Alan Jones writes in and says that his call sign is W8OAAJ. And he wrote a very nice message to us about solder smoke as knack therapy. He talks about how he's been a victim of a knack, a long-time victim. I put a picture of Alan up on the solder slideshow on the blog. His current project is he's building an accurate LC meter kit. Good project, that one, Alan. I have my almost all digital electronics LC meter here, and it's one of those things where I don't know how I lived without it. Finally, email this week is from our man in Japan, Jonathan, KC7FYS, also known as 7J1AWL. And Jonathan always sends in nice emails, and he often emails from a jammed commuter train going through Tokyo. So he's got some good solder smoke adventures going there. He's in a good location for it, of course. And he's got a young son and Oscar there with him. And I've told him that before he knows it, Oscar's going to be demanding space there on the workbench to build things with Dad. So thanks for the nice messages from Tokyo, Jonathan, and good luck with all the projects there, Jonathan-san. All right. Guys, take a look at the blog, page. I try to add something all the time. It's kind of fun. If there's something that you'd like to see on the blog, let us know, because one great thing about the blog format is that it's really easy to modify and update. So I try to put something there every few days. You can subscribe to it, and if you're using Firefox as a browser, it's really easy to subscribe to the page. There's just a little icon that you click on Firefox, and it makes it easy to subscribe. If you're using any of the web pages that you can customize, for example, I use iGoogle, and have customized the page where it has all the things that I'm interested in, all the newspapers I want to see, the weather reports that I want to see, all that kind of stuff. When you subscribe to a blog, it puts a little kind of headline thing for the blog up on the page, and every time the blog is updated, you'll be alerted to it. So it's a good way to subscribe to the blog. I really recommend it. I know a lot of guys are subscribed to the podcast. If you subscribe to the blog, it's really good too, because you'll be alerted right away if something new is added. Check out the slideshow. You'll see the slideshow on the in the upper right hand corner of the page, and you'll see the little pictures there flipping along. We've got a lot of interesting people in there. We've got all the real the heroes of QRP and homebrew. We've got Wes Hayward's in there. Pictures of Doug DeMaw. Many of the Solder Smoke listeners have sent in pictures. They're included. We've got Major Armstrong, Marconi, Dilbert, all of the heroes of homebrew. I hope nobody minds being lumped into a group that includes Dilbert. But, well, look, he had the knack too, guys, so he's with us. Anyway, send in pictures, too. Send in pictures of your projects and your shacks and your and yourselves, and we'll include them there in the big solder smoke slideshow. If you click on the thing, the pictures get bigger, and then you could look at them, and you could see the captions, and you could send in comments on the captions. Some of the pictures stay small because that's just the way they were in their original form. But send in some stuff, and we'll add it. Also on the blog, you know, it's fun to comment on the posts, and I don't think it's that difficult. If you see something you want to add a comment to or add additional information to, this is a very kind of participatory technology, so feel free to send along a comment, and then people very often will find another website or another picture that they want to alert people to, and the comments section is just perfect for that, and we like to see a lot of comments there. And check out the cluster map. You can see where your fellow blog readers are, and of course they're everywhere in the world, and we like to see more red dots added. So listen, field day is coming up. This is field day week for those of you who are going out to brave the hot weather and mosquitoes and ticks and all that stuff. Have a great time with it. It's a great event. I haven't done field day for the last few years. Maybe when we get back to Virginia, I'll go out again with the folks from Nova QRP. But enjoy it. And we used to, when I was a kid, we used to go up to the Nike Hercules base up there in Rockland County, New York, and set up our antennas where the Nike Hercules nuclear missiles used to be. Have a great field day and a good early part of the summer. We'll probably be back again with another Solder Smoke here in another couple weeks. 7-3 from Rome.